This is BSA by Design, podcast about transforming healthcare, educational, and research facilities through expert design and insight. I'm your host, Brian Moore. In this episode, we're going to discuss rural healthcare, the challenges and opportunities in this space, and working with leadership at rural healthcare systems, flexible space design, along with telehealth, and more. Let me introduce our guests, Mark Abbey and Tom Barr. Mark Abbey is a principal and a senior project architect at BSA and is located in our Indianapolis studio. He graduated from Ball State University with a BA in architecture and is a registered architect and AHCA certified. Mark has been with BSA for nearly 30 years. Tom Barr is a principal at BSA and located in our St. Louis studio. Tom graduated from Drury University with a BA in architecture, art history, and global studies. He is AIA, NCARB, EDAC, WELL-AP, and LEED-AP certified. Welcome to the show, Tom, Mark. I thank you both for joining me.
Thank you for having us.
You're both first-time guests on the show, and it's become a tradition to start out by finding out where your passion comes from. Since you're both architects, obviously, I'm looking forward to some great stories about Lego, since that's where most of you seem to have found some of your passion. But tell me a little bit about yourselves and how you kind of got here. And we'll start with you, Mark.
Well, just like you said, Legos. In the 1970s, they didn't have the booklet and told you how to assemble it. So you had to use your creativity. You weren't really limited by the little size of the blocks and shapes. There was a wide variety, and you could just let yourself go. So I'm sure you've gotten that answer from a lot of architects, and
right.
We were all from that. But as a preteen, I grew up in a rural community, and so I started building forts out in the woods where kids could be kids and let your imagination run wild. And so needing to have building materials, we used old pallets and whatever scrap wood we could find, old barrels, shingles, because you want to try to stay dry.
Right.
So there's a variety of those things. Then later in life, as I was a teenager, I took a job in the Adirondack Mountains working for a seasonal hotel resort. And I started out just as a dishwasher, but as a seasonal resort, the owner needed a lot of help around the building and the grounds. And so I was doing all kinds of beautification projects. I spent 3 summers working for her and loved every minute of it. So I ended up moving up the ranks from dishwasher and lawnmower and ended up going up a little bit earlier. And I built a bridge over the stream for patrons to be able to go from their rooms down to the main house. And that progressed into a boathouse that she needed. And if you're going to have a boathouse, you might as well have a beach. And so those were all fun things that I got to do. And she just let me be creative in doing so. That was a lot of fun. Now, where it shifted for me, I was thinking at that point in time, I was going to be instead of a hotel restaurant manager, I was going to design and build hotels. And the hospitality industry was fascinating to me.
Mm-hmm.
And then very abruptly, things changed. My grandfather had gotten sick. He was one of the most influential people in my life. And I went to visit him in the hospital. And I was amazed at how stark of an environment it was and how uncomfortable I felt, that I could not imagine that being a healing environment.
Right.
Now, I didn't realize it at the time. I was still a little naive to the world, but I went on to college and was studying architecture when he passed. And it really meant that I needed to focus on healthcare architecture. And since I graduated, I have done nothing but healthcare architecture.
That's really cool. That's a neat story. And fun that you were allowed to cook, as we like to say, creatively with someone to let you expand and spread your wings a little bit. Tom, how about you?
I share a lot of Mark's background and interest in architecture, where my passion came from. I am too from a rural community. I grew up south of St. Louis in a smaller town called Crystal City, Missouri, next to Festus, Missouri. And I was actually born outside of Philadelphia, and my parents raised horses, Tennessee walking horses, believe it or not. And whenever I was young and outside of Philadelphia in a small rural town, called Pottstown, we had a farm, and my parents ended up building a horse barn. And one of my earliest memories of seeing construction was that barn being built. And I was able to go out and play with wood and nails and different things, probably things I probably should not have been doing as much. But I was really interested in how things started coming together. And in addition to that, my father loved to draw. I feel like I come from a good family of artists. Both my grandfather, who served in World War II in the Navy, and my great-grandfather both loved to sketch and draw. And we have pictures of birds on our wall at my house that were from my great-grandfather's. He was a very good artist. And I think that just got passed down to my grandfather and then to my father. And watching them draw and seeing their sketches inspired me just to doodle and things. So even with that, I started to understand how spaces come together and are experienced. I would play with bricks outside the house whenever there are some extra ones outside of our old house that we had, and I actually broke one of my fingers.
Oh my.
And I was stacking them, and I was real little, and I heard the story that I just fashioned them together, and so I learned my lesson how not to build with those. And then of course that led to Lego. Legos are great. I have many fond memories of playing with those, and a lot of kids these days play with a computer game program called Minecraft, which we did not have growing up. So I think that, along with Lego and other tools, have been what kids these days use to replace that creativity that I only had with Lego and other things. So last but not least, a lot of my passion and inspiration came from watching how spaces are depicted in film. I gotta admit, I'm a huge Star Wars fan, and I love other sci-fi shows and movies. But early on, I was given books with illustrations and artwork from not only Star Wars, but other movies and film around the sci-fi genre. And it showed really how spaces were conceived, you know, futuristic spaces, how people are, how scales represent light and shadow, all sorts of things. And that got me really interested in understanding how people use space too.
These are two of the better introductions that I feel like we've had on the show. So thank you both very much. And you both gave such a perfect segue. So I also grew up in a rural area. I'll shout out Trafalgar, Indiana for a second, but it lends so well to the topic for today's episode and talking about rural healthcare. And we've bounced around a lot of different healthcare topics over the course of this podcast, but never really dived into some of the challenges and opportunities that rural healthcare presents. Being that all three of us grew up in that kind of environment, I know that you'll relate to this. I separated my shoulder in a basketball game my senior year. And it was 30 minutes to get to the hospital. And so I feel like we all can relate to this conversation about that's really sometimes the only option is a healthcare facility that might be 30, 50, 100 miles for a lot of people. So my first question to both of you is, why is rural healthcare getting more attention nationally right now, and why should it?
Well, this is a really big topic right now. One of the things is, rural healthcare typically struggles financially. Rural healthcare providers, particularly hospitals, are frequently the largest employer in a local community, driving significant economic impact. These institutions provide jobs and clinical support for staff, and often ranking as the first, second, or third largest employer in the rural community. As that main employer, whether as urban or rural, this goes beyond obvious employer payroll and benefits surrounding businesses that support that healthcare system. There's other businesses that benefit as well. Supply chain companies, the restaurants in the community that the patrons go to, that the staff go to when they're trying to get outside of the cafeteria. And there's other long and short-term lodging. When an individual is in the hospital for a long period of time, where does their family stay when they're in that rural community? You got to travel so far to get there. That traveling back and forth is not ideal. So for every dollar a hospital spends, there's a multiplier that benefit the other businesses in the community. This is not just a one-to-one. You spend $1 at the hospital, it stays at the hospital. It's significantly larger. And in a recent article by Chartis and Beckers, more than 40% of rural hospitals operate at a financial loss. There's over 417 vulnerable of closing right now. Yeah. And when a facility closes, it creates care deserts. So as you mentioned, 30 to 50 to 100 miles away. And that is really true for, especially for the type of care that may be a specialty. And one of the biggest ones is maternity and obstetrics. You'll also find that with oncology and chemotherapy, behavioral health, cardiology, and general surgery, just to name a few. These are all very specific, but at the same time, very consistent throughout rural communities.
Mm-hmm.
And also the type of specialty care that is consistent everywhere.
Sure. Too. As you were mentioning that access is becoming more visible and more fragile too. Growing up in a small town, we were fortunate to have a good hospital that has grown as the town has grown. But there were many times where we didn't have specific care that we needed, so we would have to drive to St. Louis. Mm. And whenever I was even younger, I remember one of my earliest memories having care in a hospital was I had pneumonia, I believe, whenever I was younger, probably about four or five. And I remember being in the hospital, and it was a big deal to go travel 40 minutes, I think it was, to get to that hospital to get the care. I feel that there's a lot of recognition that rural health isn't just a rural issue. When a hospital might be at risk with volumes, and even a lot of hospitals have been closing, just doesn't impact the community. It shifts patients into the surrounding areas and increases those wait times, strains urban hospitals, even affects regional costs. And I think that distance does create a real risk for delayed care and worse outcomes as well. So I think that it's a great question, honestly, and it's overdue, that why rural healthcare is specifically getting more attention nationally right now.
Mark, what would you say is the most common misconception people outside of rural communities have about how these hospitals actually operate?
Misconception? Due to the fact that they are a big employer in a community, some people think they can't fail. I think that the fact that they think that it can't fail is a huge misconception. As mentioned before, they're the largest employer in the community, and they create that multiplier. But if the town is losing patrons, as the small towns are not growing, their patrons are not growing. You'll also find in older communities that the patients are older, and as they expire, there's not younger folks behind them. So the less they have, the more opportunity to fail.
Tom, how does the intersection of policy, workforce, and facilities make this a uniquely complicated challenge?
I think that's where it gets really complex, honestly. Where I think rural healthcare differs the most from what people typically think about in our industry, it's because rural healthcare, you're not just solving for building or even a care model. You're navigating the intersection of policy, workforce, and facilities all at the same time. And each one of those is under pressure. And from a policy standpoint, a lot of rural healthcare is shaped by how reimbursement works. The system is still largely built around volume, how many services you provide, and that works in urban settings as well, where you have a lot of density. But in rural communities, by definition, you really don't have that volume. Mm. So you end up in a situation where hospitals are expected to maintain 24/7 readiness, emergency care, inpatient capability, but aren't always financially supported to do that consistently. And that policy structure directly impacts what services can be offered, what staff can be sustained, and ultimately what that facility needs to be. So when you layer in the workforce, providers recently that we've spoken to, which are probably the most visible on the ground, rural communities have real difficulty recruiting and retaining clinicians, physicians, nurses, specialists, often because of geography and lifestyle considerations, and also limited professional support networks. So what that means operationally is that you're designing systems where staff are wearing multiple hats. Coverage models have to be incredibly flexible, and burnout becomes a very real concern, even more so in the rural communities, I feel, what we've heard. But from a design perspective, you're also not planning for ideal staffing. You're planning for what's realistically sustainable community. So that has been a challenge I think we've faced. And then facilities sit right in the middle of those two forces, because the building is where policy and workforce realities actually show up physically. if reimbursement is tight and staffing is limited, you can't design a rural hospital the same way you would a large urban medical center. You have to think differently about right-sizing spaces so they're efficient but still adaptable, flexing program areas so rooms can serve multiple purposes potentially, designing for lower volumes but higher acuity variability, and also integrating models where stabilization and transfer are part of the workflow. And that's not easy. I mean, if you're doing a ground-up facility, that's something that you can take all those things more into consideration. Renovation, addition, that definitely becomes more challenging.
You've both been in these conversations as healthcare architects and principals that are working with some of our rural clients. What has surprised you in these conversations with rural hospital leaders?
Boy, even after 30 years doing this, I'm constantly surprised by something. Love the stories from the nurses, but I think really one thing that stands out is, and in today's world, we're hearing a lot about it, but one thing that stands out is lack of reimbursement that hospitals get for obstetrics. The cost of living goes up every day. Therefore, the cost of doing business for a hospital goes up as well. But the actual reimbursement to deliver a baby is virtually the same as it was 30 years ago. And this makes it very difficult for the hospital to use those funds to modernize and yet to pay their physicians and nurses that have that specialty. Many rural systems have actually closed their obstetrics units due to these several factors, but not limited to financial viability and staffing shortages, just declining birth rates. It's very costly to keep a birthing unit open, like Tom mentioned. These things stay open 24/7 because babies don't arrive between 8 and 5.
Right.
And on a business schedule. So those low reimbursement rates from Medicaid, Medicare, means that hospitals typically lose money on those services. Declining birth rates in a rural community means, again, less patrons, less money. Just difficult situation.
Well, I know the birth rate's been declining across the board, so you'd have to imagine it's even impacting rural communities more because there's less people. Tom, have your conversations been similar or have you heard anything different?
They have been very similar. I've been fortunate to join Mark in some conversations that we've had with leaders in both Illinois and Missouri who have recently even talked on a national level about some of the challenges that they've had. And I think what surprised me most and what honestly stuck with me is the mindset of the leaders in those communities. I went into a lot of the conversations expecting to hear primarily about challenges, and there are plenty of those. But what stood out was the level of creativity, resilience, and commitment to their communities. Mm. Wasn't unexpected, but I feel like it was beyond and above what I usually hear. And one of the biggest surprises for me was how differently they define success as well. Mm. In larger systems, success is often measured by growth, more volume, more services, more expansion. But in rural communities, it's much more about sustainability and access. Access like Mark was talking about as well. And it's about questions like, are we still here? Can we continue to provide care locally? Are we meeting the cost critical needs of the community? And are we still being that valuable leader in the community who the community can rely on? The other thing that surprised me was how interconnected everything is at the local level. In a rural setting, the hospital isn't just a healthcare provider. It's, as Mark was saying, one of the largest employers, key part of the economy, and often a central piece of the community identity. In some locations that we're currently working in, the facility is a wellness facility. People that come and work out receive occupational therapy or physical therapy and things, as well as somewhat a community center where come and hold meetings if they have a local boardroom or a meeting place that they can come to. And that level of responsibility is something you really feel in those conversations.
Tom, a lot of these buildings were designed 50 to 75 years ago for a completely different kind of healthcare. So what do you do when you can't tear it down and just start over, as you were alluding to earlier?
Yeah, it's probably one of the most common and most important questions that you get in rural healthcare. Because you're right, a lot of these facilities that were built many decades ago for a completely different model of care are challenging. And the reality is usually just can't start over. We get lucky when we can talk about starting over with clients, but it is rare and it's few and far between. So the approach really shifts from replacement to reinvention in my mind. It becomes about asking, how do we take what we have and make it work for how care is delivered today and how it might need to evolve tomorrow? We do that always, but even more so now. Mm-hmm. We don't have a crystal ball. We can't predict the future, but we have the ability to prepare more for those unknowns. And I think the first thing we do is really understand what the building can still do well for doing that. A lot of these older facilities actually have good bones, good structure, location, adjacency to the community. But the way care was organized historically, long inpatient corridors, oversized nursing units, or sometimes undersized, compartmentalized apartments that doesn't always align with today's outpatient-driven, team-based care models. So step one is identifying what we can adapt versus what we need to rethink completely. And the second piece is right-sizing and flexibility. And the third, and I think it's a big one, is phasing and prioritization. And then there's the operational side, which is just as important as the design.
Mark, I'm curious from your perspective, how you shift those conversations. Like Tom just laid out all these things. When you're talking to some of the rural hospital leadership, how do you shift that conversation from we need a new building to how do we invest strategically in what we have?
This is the smoking gun or $64,000 question. Really, this is one of those things that we want to tell everybody, master planning. We need master planning. Master planning is paramount for a rural hospital. For them to have that master plan in hand, to be able to use that methodically to plan their departments and renovations as they grow or shrink and for the years to come, like Tom mentioned, there's no crystal ball. Yet over the last 25 years, what have we seen throughout not just healthcare, but every industry? We've seen a huge explosion in technology and what technology can do. And 25, 30 years ago, the spaces we were designing that just required a computer monitor and how big that big box behind the screen was, putting televisions on the wall and things like that that's just a simple thing. You know, now we've gone to EMR and we've got, which is electronic medical records. We've got all kinds of listening devices now that can help transcribe things that doctors and nurses didn't have back in the days. So we've changed our designs to fit these technological advances. And that's been great. But one of the things is that this physical environment just needs to adapt with it. It's not just for technology. So in a recent project, we took an underutilized space and it was adjacent to an emergency department. And the way that the emergency department had been designed many, many years ago, they weren't as worried about privacy. They just wanted to, they thought just about treatment. So in this hospital, the ambulance canopy was the same as the walk-in entrance. And so when an ambulance came in after a terrible accident, a patient on a stretcher or more than one patient coming in would be wheeled right past a waiting room full of people. Nobody wants to see that.
Right.
Especially in a rural community where everybody knows everybody.
Right.
And so we took that underutilized space and we created a trauma area only and a separate ambulance entry. And that was to help those trauma docs focus on that patient, to help provide that patient with the privacy and dignity of what was being done to and for them. And yet at the same time, help keep the folks that are in the waiting room from having to see that, especially if you're in there with a small child. Right. They don't need to see that. So this was one of those great opportunities we had to improve the emergency department because of the underutilized space. And we were able to create a rapid medical exam space so that we were able to get patients that couldn't go to their doctor 8 to 5, but they were able to come to the hospital because they're open 24/7. And they bring in a child with a fever, be able to get some antibiotics. They could go into this rapid medical exam space, be seen and turn around and get back out. They're not going to be there for the long-term workup and multiple tests, blood tests, radiology, all those things, and they didn't need a separate room. So we were able to save a lot of money from building separate rooms by creating this smaller area where that was just curtained off. So those are just some of those different ways that we utilize. What do they really need to be seen for? How much square footage do those spaces need? Mm-hmm. What is the level of life safety measures that need to be in those rooms?
I want to jump back to the conversation about workforce shortage that came up earlier. And it is an issue that everyone's talking about. But do people realize how directly the building itself can make that problem worse or better?
I feel that some of our clients do, some that have had experience working on renovations before a new building construction, even if they come from a different market sector and, you know, have some healthcare background, they understand how a building can help to make things more efficient or less efficient for that matter. But there are some clients that they haven't done many projects in their past, or they don't have the luxury of doing many renovations or work all the time constantly like a large urban campus might have. And we have to help educate them. We are fortunate here at BSA to have clinicians on staff that have that experience and can help to translate what our design work means to them operationally, and also how to deal with those workforce shortages. A lot of times it's more about design and for that resilience and flexibility. These buildings have to evolve over time. The care model will change, the workforce will change, reimbursement will change. So the goal really is to create something and help to educate the client about what we can do that can adapt, what we can do to design a space that can adapt and continue to serve the community, even if it's not brand new, and take that staffing shortage consideration in mind to make the most efficient and flexible space that we can.
How does a poor floor plan actually force a rural hospital to maybe hire more staff than it needs?
A lot of times there's duplicity in spaces, and if they don't start to bring the convergence together, then you've got reception staff in two different places. You've got nurses that need to be in two different places. And when you've got a low census, they're underutilized. And so if we can create some more flexible spaces and start to erase the duplicity, and train folks so that they can, in reception, they're going to just make sure everybody's got all their paperwork done right, make sure that they're placed in rooms correctly, but they don't need to be separate. A cancer patient can be the same as another specialty, and in a waiting room, they can be in the same place. There are certain times when you want that to be separated from a privacy standpoint, and you don't want to exactly put folks that are like immunocompromised in with others that may be have a cold or COVID or something of that nature. You don't want those populations to mix. But as long as we can start to look at the spaces for treatment and make those as flexible as possible, make those about the same as possible. Keep in mind, the human body has been the same for thousands of years. And aside from those things, treatment can be done very similarly, as long as there's room around the exam table for the caregiver to make sure that they can get to both sides of the patient. It's really trying to set the room up as universally as possible so that if one day this clinic is utilized for oncology, the next day it could be utilized for podiatry. Not exactly the same type of care,
right?
But the same room can be utilized by very different doctors, but the human body, again, very similar. So those are the kinds of things where we try to figure out ways to create that universal and flexible room.
I've read a little bit about hub and spoke and racetrack layouts. What do those look like, and why do they matter in a low volume environment like a rural setting? Either one of you.
The racetrack plan is where the patients along the perimeter, because they have to have access to windows and whatnot, and the staff and the support spaces are in the center. This allows the staff the ability to be on one side or the other but get into those rooms because they have accessibility to those rooms on both sides. And yet at the same time, if a staff member is in the corridor and can look right or left and see another staff member, they can get their attention for help if they were to need an additional support for their patient. Something happens to be going south, or just for help, understanding of what that patient needs. If they're around the corner and they can't see each other, then that is a situation where the staff feels a little isolated. In the hub and spoke, again, very similar to the racetrack, the staff and the support spaces are in the center so they can keep an eye on each room and each patient. And this really helps the staff. It cuts down on the number of steps that they need to make in order to get the supplies to treat those patients. So they're able to make sure that their patient doesn't have to wait as long. It keeps down on, the steps so that the staff isn't running all over looking for supplies. They know right where they are. They're close at hand and can be administered quickly.
Tom, I've read that workforce development is starting to require physical infrastructure, training spaces, resident housing, and education environments. How do you help clients in a rural environment think about that investment?
This is one of the more interesting shifts that we're seeing right now. And honestly, it's a very important one because workforce development and rural healthcare is no longer just a program. It's becoming a place-based strategy. And what I mean by that is historically, we thought about workforce development as something that happened somewhere else. You'd recruit from outside, maybe partner with the university, maybe offer incentives, but the physical environment of the hospital wasn't really part of that equation. And that's changing. So what we're seeing now is a recognition that if you want to recruit, train, and retain people in rural communities, you actually have to support that pipeline locally. That requires that infrastructure. Because a lot of the barriers we hear from clients aren't just about wages or incentives. They're things like the lack of training opportunities, limited exposure to rural practice, no housing for students or new hires, and limited professional development pathways. And those aren't just policy issues, they're physical environmental challenges. So when we work with clients, we really try to reframe this from, do we need housing for core training space, to what does our workforce ecosystem need to look like? And that usually breaks down into a few key components in my mind. It's building that pipeline locally, creating reasons for people to stay. And with that, we hear consistently that housing is one of the biggest barriers, designing for continuous learning, not just that one-time training as well. And then integrating the workforce into a broader facility strategy. I think the biggest shift is that it's not just a separate project anymore, it's more integrated. And then when we're master planning, like Mark was referencing earlier, we're asking, how does workforce development fit into the campus then? Where do students enter and interact with care teams? And then if there is any housing or if there's any sort of partnerships that our community might have, how does that connect to the facility and the community as well? So I think the key mindset shift is that workforce isn't just staffing issue, it's an infrastructure issue as well there.
Mark, you earlier talked about a lot of the technology advancements that have been happening, of course, that we're all aware of. So I kind of wanted to shift to talking a little bit about telehealth. And telehealth to me feels like a real solution, but does it actually reduce the pressure on the building or does it just create more demands?
Well, telehealth is really probably one of those things that came about due to workplace shortages.
Mm.
Due to the specialty physicians in a rural community, when you've got one or two physicians that are your specialist or the physicians that are on staff the longest or on call even the longest, they need respite as well. When they go home to their families, the patients are still in the hospital. So telehealth is one of those things that with a camera, they can focus in on a patient and a specialist can be anywhere in the world and can zoom in on the patient. They can take vitals, the nurse can take vitals, and they can do a variety of different things and have the physician diagnose and prescribe treatment for the on-staff nursing staff to take care of them. Now, it does create some infrastructure issues as far as cameras, cables, internet service, all those different things that in the past would take up a large IT closet. I think a lot of things are getting better with the cloud, but it does help the staff from the ability to treat patients when that physician is not in the building. So it is definitely a technological advancement that has gained a lot of traction.
So then what is a command center or hybrid care environment actually look like in a rural facility?
Well, the sound command center, there's the term, it sounds like a military operation. And it really is an area where you can have the telehealth staff and or the radio for the emergency department and a variety of others that come in. And it's more a technological area, a lot of big screens where people can see what's happening and monitor what's going on throughout the hospital in order to make sure that if a patient is crashing, they can get staff from around the hospital there to them to support them. Or if they have a trauma within the community and patients are coming in, they're going to need more staff than what is on staff currently in the ED for that, so they can call throughout and have others come in. The command center, while it is, it's again, sounds like a military operation, it really is just that hub for getting all the information together in one place to be able to send it out to where it needs to be.
Tom, sticking with this topic for a minute, some rural patients and caregivers may not be as tech fluent. So how does that shape how you design technology-enabled spaces in these communities?
I feel that personally, I'm pretty savvy with technology, but as I expand in my career, I'll say, and get older, I even am challenged with some new technology in applications. And as I think about that and experience Asian populations with my own family members, it's definitely close to home. So the first thing I think of is simplicity. It becomes a real design goal. We're not designed for tech-savvy users, of course, at all times. We're designed for clarity, and I feel confidence. In my experience, any time that I don't know what I'm doing with a new software or a tool, my confidence goes away, and I feel a little embarrassed, actually. So that clarity and giving people that sense of confidence and making that feel comfortable to them is important. So in my mind, that means intuitive layouts, clear sight lines, minimal complexity and to how spaces are used, as well as the technology in a particular room environment. And the goal is to reduce anxiety, not to add to it. I feel anxious. Again, I'm going to use my own example. And I've seen my parents, I don't mind mentioning that, if they are going to a primary care doctor just for a regular well visit and things, they get all the notifications on their phone, the text message, or through their virtual app that comes with their particular system for their physician that they see, and it'll give them reminders and they can do e-check-in, and that's great. And I personally favor that, but to my parents, they're not as favorable to that. The other thing is staff support environments. A lot of telehealth in rural settings is actually what I've seen is assisted care, meaning a patient comes to the hospital clinic, nurse or staff member helps facilitate that virtual connection. Mark was alluding to that. And the remote provider joins in. So the space needs to support two or three people in a room at times. That equipment that's easy for staff to manage and workflow that feels seamless for the patient. Again, if the patient starts to feel anxious, if they feel that the team is not as well-versed or are struggling to make that visit successful and comforting and timely as well, can be a challenge. Third thing is that technology needs to be embedded, not added on. If telehealth feels like an extra step, it won't be used. So we try to integrate cameras and the monitors and the audio systems in a way that feels natural. It's invisible. So it becomes a part of the normal care experience. And that helps to reduce barriers to access. And in some cases, the hospital itself becomes the technology access point. Mm. If a patient doesn't have reliable internet at home, they may come to the facility just to connect to a specialist. And we are seeing more rural communities get better access to reliable internet at home and even other places. But we are really designing spaces that need to be welcoming, easy to navigate, and don't feel intimidating. So I think the big takeaway for me is that in a rural setting, technology doesn't replace the human experience. It has to support it and enhance it.
What does success look like for rural healthcare 10 to 20 years from now? You know, I like asking future-based questions, but what role does the built environment play in getting there too?
I think that Tom mentioned that we don't have a crystal ball.
Right.
But like I said, the human body really hasn't changed much in the thousands of years. So we really need to make sure that the buildings are as flexible as possible. The idea of universal rooms in order to be able to treat a variety of different types of patients within the same environment so that it makes it easier for the caregivers. They know right where everything is. We don't have all kinds of specialty rooms that if that specialty were to drop off, somebody moves in and then the room just isn't compatible for them because it was set up too specific. So we really need to have those adaptable, acuity adaptable rooms, the universal rooms, to really make sure that 10 to 20 years from now, that somebody doesn't walk in and say, why was it designed like this? That's the question we ask now from buildings that were designed 50 years ago.
Right.
But we don't want people asking that question of what we've designed today.
I remember working on a project, one of the first projects I worked on it early in my career, and one of my mentors told me that he actually worked at the facility we were doing a project on with, but it wasn't the exact project. We weren't replacing what he had previously did. And he told me, he's like, I hope I don't back in my career and say, why did I do it that way? But one thing, even if he did, he told me, what we always want to do is remain curious.
Right.
And we're always improving what we do. Obviously, what we're designing now and what we're thinking about is not what we thought about 100 years ago, even 20 years ago, for that matter, and something.
Yeah.
Specifically with telehealth. So to me, success means a few things. And I'll try to think through it really quickly. But I feel that it means access is reliable, not fragile. And in the future, it means that care is consistently available locally. Communities aren't worried about losing their only access point, and that patients can get the right care at the right time, whether that's in person or virtually. So it means that we need to have a better connected ecosystem, not a standalone hospital. While that's still a point of care, but it's part of a networked model of care. So we're going to see, in my mind, I hope to see a stronger hub and spoke system, regional partnerships that we already are seeing advance and grow even stronger, and really having telehealth fully integrated, not just layered on. And the goal there is to bring care closer to home. So the success isn't doing everything locally. It's being well connected, and better coordinated. Also, we're talking about workforce. It's something that we as designers don't directly influence. We have an influence. Oh, well, we have a part in that is how we design for that growth and education and training. But my hope is that the workforce is stable and supported and locally grown. That would be very successful. That would look like success for me in 10 to 20 years out. And that care shifts towards prevention, community health. I feel that that has been a strong goal and a push nationally for the last decade or two to continue to be healthier people. And I think that means stronger integration with public health, social services, more focus on chronic disease management and addressing the root causes of health issues. But as much as we as designers and engineers here at BSA can do that, I think we should be part of that. And then I think finally what that means for the built environment is that we kind of change from places to care to platforms for care. So in the future, traditionally hospitals were where care happened and it still occurs, but I feel that they can be more like platforms that enable care in person, virtually, community-based and team-based. So the building becomes a hub for coordination and diagnostics and connection and not just that treatment and prevention too, of course. And then the flexibility for that success measurable thing is that it becomes the foundation and not just the feature. So if you think about everything we just talked about, changing care models, workforce technology, the only way to support that is through adaptable environments. So I think future success for us depends on buildings that can reconfigure over time more easily, support different service lines, again, more easily, and integrate new technology without major disruption. Medical equipment is always changing. Mark, I'm sure you're aware too. I know you've worked on many projects that involve major medical equipment. And it's easier said than done to replace something that changes, and inevitably something does change. The reality is the way we deliver care is going to keep changing faster than buildings traditionally do. So the more that we can create those adaptable environments, the better.
If you could give one piece of advice to a rural hospital CEO who's about to kick off the master planning process, what would it be?
Keep an open mind, because we are going to come at you with a lot of ideas, that may be a big departure from the way the community works. And when you've had long-term employees that do things the way they've always done them, we're going to show you something is very different than what you've been doing. So that would be my first and foremost suggestion, is keep an open mind.
Well, as an architect and a healthcare principal, I want to say that we should start with your building, but it's really, you got to start with your care model. Before you draw a single line, get really clear on those services you need to provide, what your workforce can realistically support, how care is going to be delivered in your community. And I think most CEOs are aware of that or focus on that. But because if you start with a building and we start thinking ahead of ourselves, you'll end up solving the wrong problem. And really, don't design for what you wish you had. Design for what you can sustain, what they can sustain, and understand that growth. And I think that as designers and architects and engineers and clinicians that we have with our team, we're really good about working with them collaboratively, all of our clients, to understand what that means for them individually, case by case.
How can the AEC industry be a better partner to rural providers? What do we need to do differently?
In my mind, I feel you need to start with listening, not solutions. Many times I feel that as we do projects, we have experience and we take experience and we grow upon it. And what I feel that we do very well, not to toot our own, but we do listen well, but I feel that we can continue to listen more and not just think in advance and try to solve a problem. Or we might see a project come up from a lasting partner that we have, or even potential new client, and we start thinking about, oh, what could this be, or what do they need, or what do I think that this needs to be or that they need, versus truly listening and showing up with a playbook. So showing up without a playbook. So in rural healthcare, I don't think that quite works. The leadership teams need to understand that their leadership teams understand their communities better than anyone, in my mind, and they just need the time, support, and structure to translate that into a plan. So we need to spend more time understanding their challenges, ask better questions about how care is actually delivered, and co-create solutions instead of prescribing them. And that really means that we become better strategic partners, not just project partners. I think this is a big shift, because rural providers don't just need a building. They need help navigating strategy, capital planning, phasing, prioritization, and sometimes even funding pathways. So our role expands from designer to advisor and guide, helping align facilities with long-term sustainability, not just delivering a project.
That's good.
The idea that it's a rural community, they're probably not going to build a new building or an addition very frequently. So one of the things that I know as an architect, we're all looking to be the next Frank Lloyd Wright. But what we really need to do is we need to design this space and the building so that it fits in the community and it's not a reflection of our own personal signature. I want to make this one my legacy building. We really need to design for the community and make sure that the building is the most adaptable for the build, for the community. The other thing that we need to do is we need to make sure that we're taking concepts that we learn, not just in rural community, but anywhere, and bring those to those rural communities, places where we've learned about pre-manufactured items and how quickly they can be implemented to cut down on the schedule. Because let's face it, time is money. So anytime the AEC industry can shorten the length of the design and construction of a project, they get to the final product and the healthcare system starts to implement and they're getting the payback from it. So anything we can do to shorten that timeline, both in design and construction, really helps them benefit. It does that not just rural healthcare, that's universal, but it's one of those things we really need to keep in mind. How can that rural healthcare system benefit from all of these other ideas that are coming from a larger industry and ideas to be impactful for them?
Great answer. Well, thank you both for joining me this has been fantastic, and look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thank you very much, Brian.
Thank you, Brian.
I'd like to thank Mark and Tom again for joining me on this episode of BSA by Design. You can connect with them each on LinkedIn. If you want to learn more about BSA, we encourage you to visit our website at bsadesign.com. There's a link in the show notes to contact us for more information. And be sure to subscribe to BSA by Design on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube Music so you don't miss an episode. Be sure to check out BSA on social media, including LinkedIn and YouTube. That's going to do it for this episode. Join us again next time on BSA by Design.